So this is the afternoon of October 29th, PPAL 6100. Do you want me to go first, or do you want to do yours first? Do you want to go first, or do you want me to do mine first?
Now there's a fire alarm.
Take this one back.
Let's stay here till the fire alarm goes off, because it's worse downstairs. Yeah, they always come on after we had these sessions. Okay, let me do my presentation then.
Awkward Christmas bells.
It does sound like that.
Oh, we're gonna have the elves walk again.
I thought somebody was
coming. Are you hoping to get into the internet? Okay, the chicken and egg reference. Decided by the Supreme Court in 1971. Now, in 1970, the Quebec government authorized the Quebec Egg Marketing Agency to restrict the import of eggs from out of the province. Now, this was very, very good for egg producers in Quebec. Turns out that a lot of eggs had been produced in Manitoba and shipped to Ontario and Quebec. So the Quebec government was trying to protect the egg producers in Quebec by creating this power for the Egg Marketing Board in Quebec and preventing eggs from outside of the province from coming in unless they had permission from the Quebec Egg Marketing Board. Now, turns out Quebec supplied chickens to other provinces. The other provinces were restricting Quebec chickens. So Quebec was not happy about the other provinces stopping chickens from Quebec going to Ontario and Manitoba and the Atlantic region and so on. So it was really a disagreement between several provincial governments about the marketing of chickens and eggs. So, what do you think about this marketing legislation? Is it unconstitutional? Does it have anything to do with interprovincial trade and commerce? Yeah. So there are three categories of trade and commerce from the earlier decisions. One is interprovincial. That's a federal jurisdiction. Okay. Also, we have Section 121 of the Constitution Act 1867. Just let me read that to you. Section 121. All articles of growth, produce, or manufacture of any one of the provinces shall, from and after the Union, be admitted free into each of the other provinces. So the Quebec legislation would seem to be a violation of both the interprovincial branch of trade and commerce and Section 121. So, when you've got legislation that appears to be unconstitutional or ultra-virus, what do you do? Well, you go to court. How come nobody in Quebec went to court? Well, if you're an egg producer in Quebec, you really like this legislation. You're not going to go to court, right? If you're a provincial government outside of Quebec, you can't challenge provincial legislation from Quebec in your own courts. So, what can be done about this situation? Well, obviously negotiate with the Quebec government, see if there can be an interprovincial agreement on chickens and eggs. But that wasn't happening. So the Manitoba government came up with a really ingenious solution. Let us pass marketing legislation in Manitoba that restricts the import of eggs from other provinces. Okay, now Manitoba exported eggs, so to create marketing legislation to restrict the import of eggs was silly. But they did it because then they had their own legislation and they referred it to the Manitoba Court of Appeal for an opinion as to whether it was constitutional. So we have this reference procedure in Canada where the provincial governments can refer questions of any kind to their provincial courts of appeal. And the federal government can refer questions to the Supreme Court of Canada. The questions can be about anything, but usually they're about the constitutionality of legislation. So, a reference question was sent to the Manitoba Court of Appeal. Is our legislation constitutional? What did the Manitoba Court of Appeal say? You folks need some more coffee. Is it? Well, just use your common sense. Is the Manitoba legislation constitutional? Clear violation of the Interprovincial Branch of Trade and Commerce. Clear violation of Section 121. They struck it down. Oh, the Manitoba government was so disappointed they appealed to the Supreme Court of Canada. Now, Manitoba framed their legislation to make sure it was struck down by their own court so that they could appeal. What if the Manitoba legislation was found to be constitutional? They couldn't appeal it. Right? So they were delighted that it was struck down. They'd written it so it would be struck down. It went to the Supreme Court. Now, this was in 1971. 1967 to 1970, I worked at a small lodge in the Canadian Rockies, and Lake O'Hara Lodge. One of our guests, one of those summers, for 3 weeks, was Bor Alaskan, just after he'd been appointed to the Supreme Court of Canada. His wife was quite a hiker. He was not. I drove the bus. I drove the bus 3 times a day into Lake Louise to pick up passengers, bring them back to Lake O'Hara. He often came on the bus because he wanted something to do. And he went with his friend Morris Shumiacher, who was also at the lodge, and a famous lawyer from Saskatchewan. He was handled all the Morgenthaler cases in Saskatchewan. Anyway, they would chat. I was in the bus driver's seat, and they were right behind me. And they would chat. And Bor Alaskan was determined that Section 121 would have a broader interpretation. During the Judicial Council period, Section 121 was almost ignored. It says there should be free entry of goods to the provinces. Well, the JCPC gave more credence to Section 9213. So Section 121 was given very little play. So I heard these conversations of Bor Alaskan saying, well, we really do need to strengthen Section 121. We need to strengthen the Trade and Commerce Clause. Canada can't survive as a nation unless we have a business community that isn't restricted by these silly provincial barriers that have been put up. Anyway, he was on the Supreme Court. He wrote this decision. Anyway, the Supreme Court, you know, obviously struck down the Manitoba legislation. It's unconstitutional. Martland, in his decision, said the pith and substance of the Manitoba legislation is interprovincial trade and commerce. When Laskin wrote his decision, they were separate concurring decisions, both striking down the legislation. First of all, Laskin was very critical of the Manitoba government for fabricating legislation, for inventing legislation that obviously it didn't want to have in the first place, and then sending it to its Court of Appeal and from there to the Supreme Court of Canada. Why do you think he was upset about this? Yeah, it's kind of a misuse of the judicial system. And that's one thing that he mentioned. But more importantly, when judges make decisions, they like to have a lot of facts on which to base those decisions. How many eggs are actually being imported into Manitoba that they're trying to stop? How many are being exported? What is the reason for this legislation? What is the mischief that it is trying to correct? He had none of that information. So it's not really a proper judicial rule. Now, probably the Manitoba government had very little choice. I mean, it was an ingenious strategy. And they needed to get a solution. But anyway, Laskin was not happy that judges were put into that situation. Now, he had been a law professor at Osgoode Hall Law School and then the University of Toronto. He wrote the main text on Canadian constitutional law prior to Peter Hawke and then Pat Monahan. So, and in his textbook, he had ranted and railed against the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council for interpreting trade and commerce so narrowly and ignoring Section 121. So, much of his decision is a summary of what he'd written in his textbook about the whole history of, from Parsons onwards, about the attenuation of the interpretation of trade and commerce. Then he went on to say that provincial marketing legislation is okay as long as producers in other provinces are treated the same as local producers. In this case, producers in other provinces weren't. So then he looked at what is the pith and substance or the purpose of the legislation? To control the import of eggs. Therefore, it's ultra-virus. Trenches on interprovincial trade and commerce. Then he gives a scholarly analysis of both the case law and the realities of the trade in eggs and other goods. So it's a very scholarly academic decision. Now, you'd think he'd be tempted to go on to Section 121. But he didn't mention, well, he said it's not necessary to mention Section 121. And I think his strategy was this. In my decision, I've done a lot to strengthen interprovincial trade and commerce and its interpretation. And I've kind of gone over the whole history of the interpretation of trade and commerce. This is where we are. This is how we need to build on it. That's probably enough for one day. There will be other occasions when I can address Section 121 directly. He didn't want to be too radical. Any questions about the chicken and egg case?
I have a question.
Yes.
It's not necessarily to do with this. Did the JCPC hear cases in English and French that the judges in England have the capacity only in English?
Well, actually, they were more bilingual than Canadian judges for many years. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised if they heard some arguments in French. But the French lawyers who went to the JCPC, the Quebec lawyers who went to the JCPC, were bilingual. So they probably thought they had a better chance of winning if they spoke in English. But I wouldn't be surprised if they got some questions in French. While you're thinking of another question, let me just phone security again and find out if they can turn off that alarm for us. They may not even know it's on. Hopefully they don't have to evacuate the building. Oh yes, it's Ian Green in McLaughlin College. I'm teaching a class here today. The lights are back on, but the fire, the bells are ringing, and I wonder if somebody could come over and shut them off. No, after the lights goes on, yeah, that's great. After the lights go off, the alarm always comes on. Yeah, it's not a real fire, but anyway, I'm in one. Yep, I have actually a master's in college. I'm in 140 at McLaughlin College. Thanks. Bye bye.
Yeah,
if they tell us they have to leave until the fire department comes to turn off the fire alarm, why don't we try going outside? Just follow me. Well, we'll go out to the courtyard between McLaughlin College and the residence, okay? Bring your coats if you need to. I can take you downstairs. It shouldn't take very long, but I think by now I'll be okay without my coats. But so it should be about 10 minutes if we do have to leave. Hopefully that doesn't happen.
So we're waiting for the fire department now to come in and shut it off.
Security has to decide whether they should call the fire department.
So they still decide on it?
Have they determined if there's a fire yet? That's not your friend.
Okay. Anyway, stay here. Yeah. As far as we know, there's no fire.
I think yes, we'll evacuate.
You can take your question.
Shamsuddin, I have your presentation up here right now. You can come up. Any more questions about the chicken and egg case?
Have there been other cases where like governments have tried to do that, like, this like backdoor way of getting a ruling like since then? Or just kind of quash them?
Nothing this blatant. There have been many cases where provincial and federal governments have created legislation, and they do have some serious concerns, is it constitutional or not? Sometimes because of the conflicting precedents that Monahan talks about, they really aren't sure how it's going to go. So they really want to get an opinion. And the federal government did that in the 1970s when they wanted to reform the Senate. So they created legislation to reform the Senate. Trudeau said, well, I think we can do it by ourselves. Because this just affects the constitution of the government of Canada. We're not absolutely sure, so let's send it to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said, no, you need to have the agreement of the provinces. Yes?
How else could this issue have been tackled?
Interprovincial negotiation. In fact, after this decision, that's exactly what happened. The provinces and the federal government all got together. They created, they gave... Well, they created the Canadian Egg Marketing Agency. And they gave powers to the Canadian Egg Marketing Agency to regulate the marketing of eggs across the country. All the provinces passed dovetailing legislation so that the marketing legislation that was only within the province would be exactly this, have the same effect as the federal legislation. But the feds controlled the interprovincial marketing of eggs. Each province controlled the marketing of eggs within the province, and that's constitutional.
But these negotiations wouldn't necessarily result in, well, an agreement or an outcome, right? That would actually encourage the Quebec government to change their mind, right? This Manitoba's approach seems to be a lot more.
Well, you know, what Quebec wanted was to be able to have more freedom in marketing its chickens. They were facing resistance from other provinces. After this decision, they got cooperation. There was a time in the 1940s, 30s and 40s, when the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council, in a number of decisions, said, well, provincial marketing agencies are ultra-virus because some of the products they control go outside the province. Federal marketing agencies are ultra-virus because some of the province products they control are within the province only. So it appeared to be for a while that no marketing legislation would be constitutional. But that is contrary to the exhaustiveness doctrine. So eventually I think it was up to the Supreme Court of Canada, eventually said, well, and this was the famous Prince Edward Island potato marketing case. The province of Prince Edward Island created a potato marketing board. The federal government created a potato marketing board and appointed the same people to it that were in the provincial marketing board. And the Supreme Court said, that's okay, because you've got a marketing board that covers both federal jurisdiction and provincial jurisdiction. It's intravirus. So that decision really promoted a lot of federal-provincial cooperation. Shamsuddin, why don't we start in your presentation now? I'm so glad that we could use your computer.
So I'm going to present the case number 13, the Country Anti-Inflation Act, which was adopted in 1979. So now what we'll do actually is, let me just I identified the role and case background, and what I'll just discuss here, the enforcement issues and the federal government, how it contrasts each other, public opinions regarding these scenarios, and the Supreme Court situation, the Attorney General's clarification about the case, and options and alternatives. So, what I see is the role of the Anti-Inflation Act was to authorize the federal government to control the level of incomes, basically, as well as prices, profits in the key public sectors. And as well as we can see, as for example, provincial private sectors, the Act also regulated activities in the matter of property and civil rights, constitutionally admissible in the provinces, basically. So we know about some clause 9213. And the Anti-Inflation Act was Canadian Act of Parliament passed in 1975, which was at the time of Prime Minister Trudeau's government's time. And the Anti-Inflation Act was that time, that was in 1975, it was passed. And before that, actually, what is the cause that? Bank of Canada advised the government to control about the prices and wages because of inflation. So that's why the government took decisions in response of that action. However, the act was cancelled in 1979. Regarding the enforcement issues and federal government, so if I see the enforcement issues, so what are the main concern issues there? I find out two major concerns. One is the national dimension test. As a national importance of combating inflation may the subject of legislation concerning the FOG, you know, the pace, order, and good government issues. The other one is the national emergency doctrine as the basis for legislation. And at the same time, So what was the federal government attitude regarding this adoption? Usually the federal government's general power of constitutional law to enact the legislation on court challenges, this is number one. And secondly, the other one, the agreement with the provinces to support the program and in access to emergency power stimulated the province interest. So those are two main important points from federal government. Now, I want to see the comparison matter with the public opinions, how this impacts or reacts the situation. One is the provincial wages and levers. The Ontario Public Employers Union obligated the Ontario public sectors have been brought into this program without passing provincial legislation. So that was their complaint. And secondly, the other part of the economist, actually, a lead of 39 economists, so leading economists, they mentioned that the provisions actually was characterized by the judges considering the national emergency doctrine, because they are thinking that the peacetime economic regulations was much relevant. And the other issue is actually what is the background for peacetime economic regulations. So there is some relation with the federal economic legislation, peacetime. As for example, we can see this in other cases, case number 8, we can find out something in the same box. Now, what is the Supreme Court opinion actually? Supreme Court gets the situation vote by 7 to 10 majority to uphold this Anti-Inflation Act. A majority of the judges rejected inherent national importance or national dimension, whether such a broad subject matter as combating inflation can be brought into under POG situation. So, and another case is 5 of 9 judges supported the Justice Pate's opinion that combating inflation was subject to provincial jurisdiction, considering national emergency doctrine. The other point is the court has willingness, obviously, to sustain the Anti-Inflation Act as emergency legislation, but changes in provincial labor laws require an act of legislature from provinces. So this was the, okay, now, so what are the options actually? I find the 3 options. One option is actually existing, if this is, there is the existing economic crisis, so what would be the situation? The situation they identified in the case 2A. One is just to support Anti-Inflation Act. Alternative, based on along the Canada, one is Temperance Federation case. So we know about the Temperance Federation case, what is the background of this. And but there are some other relations with Section 91, in relation to POG and local prohibition case. So this is option one. And second option is, if there is no, instant threat on economic crisis, so what will be the federal intervention through parliament and provincial legislation? This is important. And they will support to measures, policies of fiscal and monetary character. So, but both of options are not actually qualified for this situation. Then the analysis came from alternative options, which was declared probably as a crisis legislation. So that crisis legislation actually came with 4 fundamental points. One point is, if there is a contradiction or disagreement with federal contention, so how it can be synthesized with different documents and what is the findings and what is the background. The other point is, federal contention assisted by preamble to the statute? And the third point, what is the rationale of the act as a crisis measure? And the fourth one is, is there any substantive grounds for option for crisis legislation, and how it will be justified on the basis or on the ground of relevant monetary policy. So according to this, actually, some other factors are relevant, as we know, the economic and social policy, government and legislative judgment, and as well as fiscal and economic policy. But the other option is the alternative, the parliaments. Of course, parliament was strong to intervene the interest of the country, as a national emergency this situation. So usually there is some debate on this, but regarding all this question, the concluding point is, so what is actually the background or matter to consider the serious national concern about this situation, and how they will justify the situation as a national concern. The another issue is if there any background, I mean, regarding the Anti-Inflation Act, which was enacted correctly or not, but it was found that the Anti-Inflation Act was not enacted as per provisions written in the constitutional law. And finally, the judge decided that this is beyond the existing regulations. So it seems true that the situation faces some legal crisis. So that was the decision. So as a result, the Anti-Corruption Inflation Act was not sustained as a manner that was discussed and obligated. So that is my presentation. Thank you very much. If you have any questions.
Thank you very much. And see you. First student to present when bells ring. You can just stay here for a moment if you like, in case there are questions for both of us. So most of you were not born in 1974. And so I was. This was a huge, huge issue. 1974, there was a federal election. Trudeau was the leader of the Liberals. We had a huge amount of inflation in those days. Hard to believe, given that we haven't had inflation like that for a long time. But inflation was up, sometimes up around 10%. So every year you expected the cost of everything to go up 10%. And you also expected your wages to go up 10 or maybe 15%. That was quite common. You buy bonds that got 10% interest. Stock market was up around 20%. It was galloping inflation. So Robert Stanfield, the leader of the Conservative Party, said, we need to bring this under control. We need wage and price controls. Trudeau said, no, we don't. There are rounds of inflation throughout history, and we'll have other policies that'll deal with them. And we don't need wage and price controls, because, of course, the unions were very much against them, and some businesses were against them. So Trudeau won the election. His people in the Department of Finance persuaded him, we do need wage and price controls. So 1975, the feds negotiated wage and price controls with every single province. We had dovetailing legislation, just like the egg marketing legislation. Every province agreed that we needed wage and price controls. It was going to be an absolute disaster if we didn't do something about inflation. And so inflation was limited to, I think, 6% in the first year after this, 5% in the year after. And there are all kinds of mechanisms for rolling back collective agreements that had already been put in place. It was very comprehensive legislation. So it seemed like there was a national consensus we needed to do this, but one of the unions in Ontario said, we don't agree with this, because they had their wages rolled back. So they went to court. Their case eventually, sent as a reference to the Supreme Court of Canada, because once the Ontario Union said, we think this is unconstitutional, that would go through the court for years. In the meantime, other unions would say, we're paying no attention to this. So they needed to get an answer quickly. Was this legislation constitutional or not? And so the question was the federal Anti-Inflation Act and all the provincial legislation that dovetailed with it, was it constitutional? And this is a fascinating case. It was so controversial at the time. It was the first case in Canadian history where the Supreme Court of Canada had allowed social science evidence to be introduced. Now, social science evidence had been introduced in the United States since 1908. In a famous case, it was brought by a lawyer who was later a judge, Louis Brandeis. So his social science evidence was known as the Brandeis Brief. In Canada, social science evidence was disallowed till 1976 because it was considered hearsay. Social scientists go out and they interview people, right? They summarize the interviews. They make an analysis based on that, but it's all hearsay, it's all interviews. So, but finally in 1976, the Supreme Court said, no, we'll allow the social science evidence to be introduced. We may not pay any attention to it, but you can introduce it. So 39 economists, no, 40 economists, including Lipsy. Have any of you read books by Lipsy, the famous economist from Queen's University? Well, he was all the rage when I was an undergrad student. Anyway, they all introduced affidavits in court saying that inflation is not a crisis. So some of the economists said, yeah, it is a crisis, but most of them said it's not a crisis, it's just a normal part of the business cycle. Anyway, the court didn't pay a lot of attention to that social science evidence. Stats Canada had some evidence showing that there was a rational basis for believing that there is a crisis. Well, you've learned about the emergency doctrine. The government of Canada went to court saying, well, we think we can justify this legislation under the national concern branch of peace, order, and good government. They wanted to expand the national concern branch. Inflation is a matter of national concern. Because of the contradictory evidence from the economists, they didn't want to put all their eggs in one basket. They were afraid to argue that it's an emergency, but they put that argument in just in case. So there were three different decisions. We didn't have a majority in this case, so the results are confusing. Laskin and three judges wrote one decision. And Laskin, after reviewing all the cases involving the emergency branch of peace, order, and good government, said, I don't think you can say inflation is an emergency, but it's definitely a crisis. Yay! We'll just finish this case, make sure that the fire department doesn't come, and then we'll head downstairs again. So he said it's not an emergency, but it is a crisis. And so what he did is he expanded the emergency doctrine to include crises. Now keep in mind, up until this time, an emergency was a war, some sort of health crisis, an epidemic of some kind across the country, or an epidemic of drunkenness. Those were the three areas of emergency. Inflation wasn't covered in any of this, so Laskin didn't think he could follow precedent and say that inflation was an emergency. But it is a crisis, and there was lots of evidence. He didn't say the feds had to prove it was a crisis. He said, as long as there's evidence that it's a crisis, that's rational, it's really up to the government to decide yay or nay. But yes, there's credible evidence, so we'll accept the government's argument that it is a crisis. So Laskin tried to expand the emergency doctrine to include crises that might include things other than inflation. He said, therefore, it's unnecessary to talk about the national concern branch. Now, it's interesting that Mr. Justice Ritchie, supported by two other judges, rejected Laskin's crisis doctrine. We can't expand the emergency doctrine. It's there already. So we have to leave things as they are. But inflation is an emergency. So two separate decisions. Together they make up the majority supporting the legislation, but for two different reasons. One expanding the emergency doctrine, one saying, no, we can't expand it. None of them have the majority of the court. So what is the holding? We don't know. Judges in the future can pick and choose. Then we had Betts plus another judge. That's spelled B-E-E-T-Z, but it's pronounced Betts. Betts agreed with Ritchie. You can't expand the emergency doctrine. But he disagreed with Ritchie. He said inflation is not an emergency. It's not a war. It's not an epidemic of pestilence. It's not drunkenness. It's not an emergency. So, did Laskin succeed in expanding the emergency doctrine? Well, we had five judges saying you can't do that. But two of them were dissenting. So we don't know. Monahan, in his book, doesn't talk about the crisis doctrine. It's really too confusing for him to mention it. But I just wanted to mention that's in the decision of four judges. Now, the other thing that is really interesting here is that the Ontario government didn't pass legislation dovetailing with the Federal Wage and Price Controls Act because they were in a minority situation.
Yes.
And so they just passed an order in council. Remember the discussion from last month about primary and secondary legislation? Primary legislation is passed by the legislature or by parliament. Secondary would be an example, that would be orders in council. But the orders in council have to be authorized by the primary legislation. In Ontario, there was no primary legislation that said the cabinet can make regulations with regard to inflation. Didn't exist. So the Ontario legislation was struck down because there was no primary legislation that authorized the cabinet to act as it had. Now, shortly after that, things were resolved in Ontario. I can't remember whether there was another election and the government got a majority or whether the unions came on side, but anyway, legislation was passed by the provincial government and it did dovetail with the federal legislation. So we did have wage and price controls for a few years. Now, the important point that both Laskin and Ritchie made, and Betts, any legislation like this that is passed under the emergency or crisis branch of peace, order, and good government is temporary. You can interfere with provincial jurisdiction, even if the provinces say you can, only for a particular period of time. And then when the crisis is over, you have to repeal the legislation. And that was done, I think it was 1979.
Yeah.
Okay, so any questions about this very famous case for Shams and me?
I'd like to add actually one point. So this is maybe the one appropriate example to see the balance of provincial and federal legislative measures and situation. And this can even clarify the federalism or centralization or decentralization issues even. So there is no biasness in one. So it is just a state. Mm-hmm. I mean, because of that, actually, since at that time Ontario government was a minority, mm-hmm. so they were not able to pass any bill. So that was the contradiction. So as a result, now this is like they put down for even issues on labor and wage issues. So that's a contradiction totally.
Yeah, that's right. And it's amazing that the Ontario government did that. So all of you now know that secondary legislation is invalid unless there's primary legislation there that authorizes it, that says you can make certain kinds of regulations. So in your work, make sure that the secondary legislation that governs what you do is actually authorized by primary legislation, or else your actions may be an abusive process. No more questions? Let's head downstairs again then. If somebody wants to take the coffee, that would be great. And we'll do at least a couple more presentations. Yeah, we have an hour before our speaker comes. Thank you again.
There's no way I can fit anything in this.
I'm not trying to do that with that stuff.
It should be. I don't know how to.
I think this is still on.
Oh, thank you very much.